Hello and welcome to the Private Capital Podcast. I'm Joe Riley, and I've been in the family office world for over 20 years. Michael Tiedemann is a founding partner and chief executive officer of Alti Global, a publicly traded $70 billion investment firm. He is also a member of the firm's board of directors and chairman of the firm's internal investment committee. We talk about starting the business with his father, Carl Tiedemann, the former president of DLJ, spinning up a wealth manager from scratch after the dot-com collapse, the importance of having an operator mentality, finding great talent, and Mike's thoughts on venture, private debt, growth in the wealth management space, and being deliberate. Michael began his career working for Tiedemann Investment Group as an emerging markets research analyst. In 1994, he joined the equity research group at Banco Garantia, one of Brazil's leading investment banks, living in Brazil for 2 years. Later, Michael ran their equity sales and trading operations out of New York, where he worked closely with Garantia's top-ranked hedge fund of funds group. In 1998, when Credit Suisse acquired Garantia, he remained there, heading up their sales trading efforts for Latin America until he left to start Tiedemann Advisors in 2000. Michael received a Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology from Ohio Wesleyan University. If you like these discussions, please subscribe or leave a review. And please enjoy my talk with Mike Tiedemann.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Anything said by the guests or host should not be construed as legal or investment advice. Thanks for listening.
How did you get interested in investing when you were young? Were you very influenced by your father's career?
I was. My father was someone who really loved, as everyone called it, Wall Street. What he loved about Wall Street was the fact that you were always learning about every other industry. You're in finance, but you were investing in and researching and ultimately taking a view on whether it be healthcare or energy or all the spaces and all the change over time and the changes in regulatory framework and tax and what have you. And his view was, and I share his view at this point, that it's just a constant source of learning, and you're meeting people who are domain experts across these various areas, and you're constantly surrounded by people who know more about a specific subject matter than you. If you enjoy that, enjoy being around people and enjoy watching the changing times and changing trends, it's not a static, it's a really dynamic industry to be in. And I studied psychology and I love psychology. I didn't enjoy studying finance in school. I enjoyed living it and being in markets and having it be much more tangible. But without question, the advice that he gave me, or his opinion that I now share, was just how dynamic and constantly changing it is. There's nothing but, it will never be a boring sector to be in.
And did you think about going into psychology?
No, I just really enjoy the teachers. By the way, it's very helpful and dealing with people, whether it be employees or partners or clients, prospects, really just understanding psychology is it's a very practical subject matter to have as a background.
And who are your influences in investing? Are you a values guy?
That's a great question. I'm an operator and an investor, so you can't not respect someone like a Warren Buffett, who just has a time-tested approach and really, in many ways, a very simple approach to investing, and he's unswayed by short-term trends. And he also admits when he's wrong and exits positions. So I think someone like that is a testament to just an operating mentality, understanding a business that generates free cash flows and then how that business reinvests those and maintains a leadership position in the space in which it operates. I think when you operate a business, you have to have that mentality at all times. So I take that as an executive. I'm always thinking about what we are doing or not doing well. I think about it from the customer or the prospect. I think about the trends in the space, and I can talk about that later. But for example, single family office as a growing trend, how do we serve and engage single family offices in some portion of their formation or perhaps reformation as the needs change through generations, and how we can be the best counterparty to them and participate in that trend ultimately commercially. Buffett is definitely one. And then as you learn about great distressed investors or credit investors, and they have a totally different mindset, a totally different skill set in many ways. And then there are people who are great at sort of relative value arbitrage. And I'm longtime partners with Drew Figdor, who is an event-driven strategy, and just seeing the discipline that they operate with. I mean, you can't have enough respect for people who just year in, year out, have an incredible understanding of how to manage risk and how to evaluate both risk and opportunity. And they have a great ability. All of them have their own and different abilities to block out the noise and to really focus on the key fundamentals that matter. And this has been a really unique trailing decade, 12 years plus, where you had zero rates and it had this distorting effect and really damaging effect on fundamental investors. It was a combination of zero interest rates for the longest prolonged period of time that we'd seen in history, capital infusion by governments in manners that we'd never seen before, and indexation. And the indexation power and the concentration of 7 or 10 names into the S&P 500 has been such a just an enormous, powerful effect that has made active investing pressured consistently. And you're only beginning to see that normalize now, where you have base rates at levels where they should be. You're beginning to see fundamentals play through. You still have the power of the indexation. You still have the concentration of a few names in the S&P that makes that a benchmark very hard to compete against as an active manager. But ultimately, you're beginning to see now fundamentals play through. And I think that will be the theme of the next 5 years, if I were to wager a bet.
How do you think quants have affected the space? And do you folks invest in quants?
Quants have created an interesting dynamic, and it's not a one-sided dynamic. I think there's some positives in so much that there's obviously the term quant covers a lot of different styles and strategies, but in general, they're a higher velocity investment strategy. By definition, they will be on both sides of almost every stock, creating some volatility, but they're also creating a lot of liquidity. They will be on either side. And so you've got some very large firms, brand name like Citadel, what have you, that when you really look at the liquidity of equity markets, they're massive players as liquidity providers and the dark pools and what have you. So they do have an impact. They also have an impact in terms of just momentum, and sometimes it's shorter term momentum. But what that at extremes will do is create opportunities for disciplined value or fundamental investors who see mispricings that are being driven much more technically than fundamentally. And ultimately, it enables them the ability to add to a position or initiate a position in a company that they're following and doing work on that is caught up in shorter term technical related issues. But we do invest. I think a lot of the strategies, most multi-strategy hedge funds have some dynamic of quant in their strategy. May not be the overriding dynamic, but there's no question they have teams and capital being deployed in that manner.
Did living in Brazil change the way you look at global markets?
Living in Brazil, it was a remarkable life experience on a lot of levels. One, educationally, in terms of markets and inflation, in terms of reform, it was the tip of the spear of the Brazilian real. So when I arrived in Brazil, it was Ayrton Senna's funeral day. So they had shut down the markets. 2 million people walked through his funeral procession. It was really, I didn't know who he was. They had closed the markets, every channel. And everyone was hanging their head. It was really amazing to see. He was the hero of the country. Mm-hmm. At the time, they had 35% inflation a month. People would go to the back of the grocery stores in the morning because they hadn't adjusted the pricing stamping on them. So they had about 2% cheaper price. It was a bit chaotic, but they created the Real plan, and I watched inflation be tamed. And by and large, it has remained, let's call it elevated, but under control since that point, even through a lot of the devaluations that occurred later in the 1990s. I saw volatility firsthand. This again was in the 90s when the U.S. was undergoing an incredible bull market. The Mexican devaluation, you had Asia, you had Russia, just rolling crises. And it was incredible to watch capital flight and incredible to watch who was benefiting and who was really caught in those moments. The firm I worked at, Guarantee, which was an incredible talent source, just some of the smartest people I've met to this day, we were ultimately caught on the wrong side of certain trades and ended up being forced to sell to Credit Suisse at that time. Shortly thereafter, Credit Suisse had their they lost several $1 billion in Russia. So it was a really interesting and dynamic time to be working in emerging markets. And then, of course, I returned to start and found Tiedemann, at the time it was called Tiedemann Trust Company or Tiedemann Advisors. And I started on March 10th, and that was literally NASDAQ peak right as the bubble burst. So what market was I going to go to next? Was certainly one not to invest in. But yeah, that was the start of the firm. And it was actually it was the first exposure that we...
It was really, you know, in March of 2000 was the bubble bursting. And that was when we decided to start the company. We really got our Delaware Trust Company license in December of 99, but I joined March 10th with Craig Smith, co-founder. And we had no clients. And the NASDAQ was at 5,000, and I think it took 15 years to get back to that level. It was really the beginning of very challenging equity markets. But what we had was an approach and a use of alternatives that at the time, as well as an open architecture model, that was really what enabled us to begin to find clients and to offer a differentiated investment approach as well as a different model, which was really the start of the open, from our standpoint, the start of the open architecture advisory model in full, where we just were completely committed to it, having no conflicts in any of the advice we were giving, no ownership over any of the underlying asset managers that our clients were investing in. And that really, that was the doorstep of that fundamental change, and certainly in the U.S. in terms of the open architecture model being the model that very large families were seeking.
I'm very interested in the conversation that led up to that, and there's a great family business angle to this. It's unusual for a son and a father to start a business together. Usually the son is brought in.
Yeah.
But you folks were partnered from the beginning. And I'm interested in what the conversations were like leading up to that and when you guys decided to pull the trigger.
There's a family history that my father would tell, which was his father was actually ran a horse blanket business in Cleveland, Ohio, and the turn of the century and then into the Great Depression. And so my father's father, and he found out later he took his life, he went bankrupt in the Great Depression. And he was a horse blanket business. He had the start of the Model A Ford car. So cars were coming. It was like being a CD salesman with the iPod coming out. And he was overleveraged and he felt like a failure and took his life. My father found that out when he was 30 years old. So his entire life was oriented around being optimistic and being a business builder and repairing the Tiedemann name, because he felt great shame about his father taking his life. And I didn't fully appreciate that until I was giving my father's eulogy. I always matched my own optimism relative to his, which made me feel not overly optimistic. I am an optimistic person, but his was almost in self-defense in many ways. But his grandfather, my father's grandfather, was chairman of American Tobacco, so Lucky Strike cigarettes. And when his grandfather passed, he left in trust. It was 1932, and so coming out of the Great Depression, he left in trust $100,000, which at the time was a great amount of money. And 40 years later, it was in trust, started with Bank of Cleveland, and then went through a lot of bank mergers. And in 1972, when his mother passed, he inherited it, it was $100,000. So 40 years from the base of the Great Depression to 1972 was all he needed to see to know that there was a better way to have generational assets be managed, and certainly one without conflicts. Tiedemann Trust Company, set up in Delaware, was set up to bring the good parts of institution, permanent, regulated, compliant systems, resources, et cetera, but remove the negative parts, which is turnover, conflicts, and we've been able to accomplish that. But that was the origin. The conversations with him were based on that. He was 74 years old. I was starting a business. I was the young one at the time. I was 29. It was like a long time ago. And I remember thinking to myself, I am absolutely crazy starting a business with a 74-year-old. But my father was not your normal 74-year-old man. He was really an exceptional visionary and this believer in building financial services that didn't exist and that he felt had a place to exist. And that was the origin of the conversation. We had no clients. The first year, I really was questioning my decision. I left a high-paying job to go to a startup, but it was really fun. Craig and I used to sit, we were sharing an office and coming up with all the policies and procedures of the business and investment platform and whatnot. It was really like something that you only do when you're 29, 30 years old and have no kids.
But we're now look back, and every now and then we smile and think about some of those moments in time.
Well, what was that first year like? You started with no clients. Obviously, folks, I'm sure, had some contacts and some leads, but still, you basically had to spin it up from scratch.
Yeah, we had a great concept, and I think it finally resonated. But there's a family who's still with us, and they're just a fabulous family. That's a single family office, and we've worked with the team and the family since inception, and they were the first ones to join. Now, I think we later told them about 10 years later that they were the first. They were like, oh, we didn't know we were the first ones. But they are just a terrific family, and really a testament to the team that has been here the entire time working with them, and the trust that can develop, and through all the markets and all the things that have gone on in the world and changes in their lives, what have you. I think we've tried to, we use them as an example of a family that you can really serve meaningfully and in a variety of different ways as we've changed and as they've changed. But that first year was lonely. And I remember because of my father's experience with trust, none of the kids in our family, I was the youngest of four, we didn't have any trust. And my father was very much get your own summer job and buy your own bicycles. And I was raised that way, which I like very much and will try to do my best with my kids. I have four of my own. But the first year was a lot of reflection on whether or not this was potentially a mistake. We heard our own voices a lot. A lot of people asking us, why a trust company? Isn't that a terrible business? And we were like, that's the point. We're trying to cure what we think is a really important institutional infrastructure. And when I look at how we've served families for 20 years, the planning that we've done with families and their lawyers has enabled transfer of assets and the most meaningful structural changes to these families. We think we're really good investors, but it's very hard to outperform year in, year out. There's not a manager in the world who does that, really. But when you create great structuring and combine it with great investing, there's a lot of benefit that accrues to these families. And that's having it coordinated with teams that work together very closely is a really critical and important to it. And a huge value add to our clients.
Is there anything a wealth manager could learn from your early years? What things you wish you could have planned for? Would you do it again?
I would definitely do it again. Yeah, that's an easy one. It's been very blessed. And I think the advice I would give, I don't know if it only extends to a wealth manager, but I think in general, if you are in a business that is a service business or a competitive industry that is dealing with some measure of change, and I don't think there is an industry today that isn't going through some source of change. I think that's what technology and AI and all the things that these influences that you're seeing. I think the one thread that crosses over all service industries is what is the customer experience? What is changing in terms of their needs? And being very sober in your self-analysis as to whether or not you think you actually have an architecture of systems that is either keeping up or leading edge, a service model, the right people, where are we weak? Where could we be better? Just constantly probing yourself and your business, being your own worst critic in many ways, and then recognizing that you're in a human capital business and you have to develop a culture that makes people want to work with you. The clients feel that. The prospects see that in the meeting, whether there are two or three or four people presenting to them, whether they get along. They're different offices from around the country, and do they let each other finish their sentences? And just all those little dynamics are really important. Respecting the fact that you're in, I would argue, the ultimate human capital business. You are dealing with the most sensitive and intimate client-related matters, period. More about their families and the dynamics within their family than their best friends. A lot of times the best friend doesn't want the other friend to know exactly how much money they have or these final decisions. And we really are in a very an honored seat to sit in, and one that is it's very private. And you cannot have those people turning over. It's a family trusts one, two, or three people as part of the team, but typically it's one or two people. And if they're rotating in and out because you have a work environment that's not conducive to maintaining stability and paying people fairly and equitizing people and just creating a great work environment, that's going to be a problem.
How did you think about the tension between staffing and growth for the first 10 years?
We were just head down, everyone doing everything. That's an exciting part of being an entrepreneur. And then there's a tipping point where that's not a functional or high functioning reality. You do have to create structure, accountability, division of labor, and then you need to create depth to the organization. So the first 10 years, we laugh about a lot of the partners that I've worked with for 20 years, who are real friends. I know their wives and kids, and we've gone through everything together. And that's what, in part, what makes it special. We were all just literally working on documents and printing stuff out, and it was just all hands on deck approach. And that is, there is something that's really fun about that. And then there's also something that is just untenable or unsustainable about it at a point. So the first 10 years were much more oriented around that. And then really the team was the one that said, yeah, we need to create more structure, and we need to have people who have defined skills lead certain areas and then build the depth below them. And then obviously create the career paths for all those people at the various levels in the firm. I think we've done a good job of that. We've been very intentional about it. And with that, we really have focused on being as diverse as we can be. We see the huge benefit to that, not just because of the message it sends to the outside world, but also because of just the culture that you can develop internally, the balance that's created by that culture, just in terms of the way people think, act, treat each other, and also then the next generation, how your ability to attract really good talent, when they see men and women throughout the organization at various levels, they actually see a path for them more easily than a firm that is a standard Wall Street male-dominated firm.
So you've been fortunate enough to be successful across different types of roles, investment banking, alternatives, and wealth management. I wonder how that informs your decision-making about filtering talent for your different business lines, not just the wealth management.
Yes, this is part of our opportunity, which is also will be a challenge, is when someone looks at Alt from the outside, what are they, and once thinks about buying the stock, what am I buying? What is this? And in some ways, it's quite simple. We are managing and overseeing and investing multi-generational pools of capital in case of a family or foundation. And then we have alternatives, whether it be real estate or in fund form, that are managing capital in product form on behalf of other institutions and organizations that are seeking a return stream that's differentiated. As we look to build from here, the wealth, we really believe in being an integrated wealth manager and the power of integration and having there be a unified operating platform. There's the controls and compliance and all the things that are needed that come from that are really critically important. But then there's also the growth that gets unlocked where you have people collaborating, and whether it be across jurisdictions or just bringing skill sets to help an advisor present to a prospective family or a foundation, and you can bring in someone who's an expert within our firm. And we're a firm, I think one of the defining characteristics of our firm is that we collaborate and that people really want to see others across the firm succeed. And that's very unique, I would say, in the financial world to have that as an explicit part of our culture. And so as we integrate teams or individuals or a new firm, it has led to growth with great consistency because we're bringing resources, and it enables those individuals to go back out into their world and retell their story and say, oh, look, now I've got these different capabilities. I've got a Delaware Trust Company. I've got an impact team. I've got family generation governance and dynamics team, and we've got international capabilities. It enables them to really retell their story and tell it with excitement, and then obviously, they can bring in the resources as and when need be. The talent on the investment side and the talent opportunity that we're focused on, let's call it the strategic alternative side, is really the middle market in a lot of the spaces in the alternative space, whether it be real estate, private equity, impact private equity, or non-correlating hedge funds. There's a certain size and scale that firms can reach, and we believe they've done, first of all, the very hard work. Is that first $1 billion you raise as a fund, or fund 1, fund 2, fund 3, you're putting it, you're raising it, you're deploying it, it's that sort of hyper entrepreneurial stage. And we believe these are firms that we can buy into and help take them to the next level, to that sort of institutional size level. And they are not looking to sell. These are people that are typically not on offer
we know them through either we've been invested with them for the years or we know them through our broad network. They're interested in us as a growth investor into their business. And that's where we ultimately think there's a great talent opportunity on this alternative side. Our clients on the wealth side want to benefit and want to invest into that via the GP as well. So we, if you think about the wealth offering, they can invest in the GP, they can invest in the LP if they choose to, and then their co-investment opportunities that get generated from all these managers over time. So it's really a menu, and it's all driven by the clients. These are not assets that end up in discretionary portfolios. These are ones that, you know, large families are now looking for more and more co-investment opportunities, more differentiated investment opportunities, such as GP staking, than just your standard liquid market portfolio.
What's the current AUM?
It's over $70 billion. And then we have just yesterday announced the East End team, which is a terrific team that we've known and competed against for years. And their orientation has been on the very highest end of the market, work with some incredible foundations and families, very large. And we, again, that's a perfect example. They have this OCIO model that's worked extremely well. They have an incredible reputation with the managers in which they invest. They have great results. We bring trust capabilities, impact, non-US. So there's really a great complement to one another. But above all that, it's an exceptional group of human beings. The whole organization is, we've already been engaged in sharing investment concepts and ideas for almost close to a year. But the principles of the firms go back decades. And so there's just an immense trust that comes with it.
I think it might have been Liz Nesvold who said you have to build up an M&A muscle over time. And so I'd be very curious, and Tiedemann has been very deliberate about M&A over the years, and has been very focused originally on growing organically.
Yes.
But there have been strategic investments, so maybe we'll take those one at a time. I'd be very curious as to what the background for the Presidio acquisition was and how that came about.
Thank you for using the term deliberate, because that is the way we've been very cautious. And we think the world is littered with a lot of bad M&A deals, specifically in finance. So we entered it with a lens of suspicion. And in the case of Presidio, we saw an organization that had a footprint that was really complementary to ours, i.e. San Francisco, where we had a small office, Dallas, which is a big growth market, and the DC Bethesda area. So a team of advisors who were very good with their clients, good people, talented, but an organization that needed some structural change and new leadership in general. So the advisors were very open to the concept of the leadership changing to, at the time, Tiedemann. And so we were able to do, and we did an equity merge. We didn't want to gear our balance sheet, and we wanted them to roll their equity. So we created the equity framework around that. And I think from their standpoint, I think they did a very good deal joining us. I think we helped one another, and we're all still partners to this day. So it was I think very successful. The threshold shortly thereafter, we brought Liz Nesvold, funny enough, in to that and as an advisor. And then about 7 months after we closed that transaction, Liz called me and said, "Hey, Mike, I've got this firm called Threshold."
And Threshold was a unique firm.
They were very, and great people and great family. The founding Russell family is a terrific family. And they had great female leadership. They had incredible impact. They had a lot of components. We've got a family office services team that we now is like leading our practice. They were a great addition culturally. They really pushed us on the way in which we present ourselves to the world. The impact team and the growth that's come from that has been immensely important, but also just the understanding of something like blended finance. Jed Emerson, who now leads our impact effort, we were introduced by them, and then we developed, obviously, our relationship, and we invited him to join us on this journey as a public company. So that advanced us in a different way than the way Presidio advanced us. But, and then Constantia was almost going back to the entrepreneurial, where we said, look, we'll back a small team in Europe. We felt our offering cross-border insufficient. It's the nicest way I could put it. I felt that as a client experience, I didn't feel like we could really serve cross-border families. And we had a lot of families who had cross-border marriages or had assets across over the Atlantic Ocean. And we just said, and we also began to look at the competitive environment and said, wow, we can really compete well over there. They're a decade behind us in terms of fragmentation. As we've gotten more and more non-US, seen that there are regional players, i.e. there's a great UK firm or there's a great UK and Swiss, but there are very few that are in Italy, Lisbon, Singapore, Hong Kong. Like, we really can traffic seamlessly across all these areas. And so we've just put it together. And we spent the last year integrating. And if you've ever integrated firms, it's a lot of labor. It's more laborious than glorious. And it's new systems, it's new processes and controls, it's new bosses. It's a lot of change. And it's really important that you address it and complete it and be committed to completing it on a date certain, so that way you can get back to working and begin working together in earnest.
Tiedemann has a distinct culture. How do you think about integrating that?
Engagement is the best way. We have 24 offices. Engagement is the best way. People tell me I'm like a dinosaur. I do believe in office culture for a lot of reasons, and I'll stand on my soapbox for a second and tell you why. I think it's important to leave your home at home and leave your work at work and create that division of space, and the commute ultimately, while annoying and costly and time consuming, creates that buffer zone. I think it's very hard. You're asking people to manage remotely. All these dynamics it's an experiment. I think the experiment, portions of it have succeeded. I think there are clearly job roles and functions that work very well remotely full time, or at least a day of the week if you're going to read and write a document and you just want to stay in your home and do that. But when you're engaging with people, and there's a fluidity of that, there are little lessons that are being learned and taught each day in a meeting, how someone answers a question, how someone responds to a challenge, how someone engages. There are all these little things that I think are lost by being remote. And even group meetings, when you have more than two or three people on a Zoom, I think you lose the dynamism of a conversation. Having people in offices and having great office cultures, if you don't like going to the office, you're probably working in the wrong firm. You should like being around the people you're working with. That's how you create a culture. You hire good people. And as importantly, you get rid of people who don't fit. You get rid of people who are office culture killers and political. And I think that's how it's engagement, ultimately. You have to engage the people you have to convince. I'm committed this year to traveling to see people, see our clients, spend time with our various offices, and it's an investment that does pay you back. Those connections that get built, and they get built in person, they don't get built on Zoom.
Do you find it's a competitive advantage for overseas families who want to be involved with a U.S. firm?
Time will tell. I think there are definitely advantages to people see the U.S. and they see a lot of the great investment firms, a lot of the venture capital and growth equity. And so there's no question that from an investment standpoint, they see the U.S. as a place that you want to have connection to and research access to and investment access to. So there's that, I think, is a yes. How that translates to jurisdictional, whether their assets come onshore or not, how much of that gets caught up in political views or views related to wanting to stay away from the U.S. or there are a variety of different ways to think about it. But I think on balance, having a great investment team and infrastructure here in the States is an advantage globally. Most firms don't. Most non-U.S. firms do not have a presence. And we're doing the other way. We had the U.S. presence, and we're really going internationally. And we think that will ultimately benefit us greatly, because I think we have a unique infrastructure, we have unique capabilities, and we're exclusively oriented at the very high end. So if you're a large family in any of these markets, we're a substantially competitive organization to consider when you're thinking about how you want your families to be served.
So take us along for the ride on this recent merger and public offering through SPAC. It's a fascinating story, which doubled the company and brought it global seemingly overnight. How did it begin? And more importantly, when did it actually begin to make sense to you based on the history of the company and the deliberate process?
There are a couple of considerations. One is my personal perspective of being a partner in a wealth business and a longstanding alternatives business.
How has that worked traditionally?
They were separate businesses, separate client bases. And I was really the only overlap between the two, and I was the controlling partner of both. So I really had insights into both, insights into the competitive landscape, the trends, and the economics of how the
the two worked through market cycles. So I had 20 years of visibility, and I really see the benefit of having that under one combined currency. And the reason is because both have great long-term tailwind trends. The alternative space, whether it be real estate or private equity or impact private equity, hedge funds, they all have secular trends that are powerful. And then obviously you've got the family office and wealth creation and transfer of wealth trend that is, they're both undeniably positive and powerful. So we've got these tailwinds behind us. What makes it unique is that if both of them operate with synergies, if both of them operate appropriately independent of one another, but also collaborating on IP, collaborating on making sure that we have exposure to or entering into these long-term investment megatrends. So i.e. in the GP staking, making sure that our focus is oriented around buying into organizations that are operating in spaces that we want to invest capital generally as wealth or other institutions. And the benefits that come from that over time, it creates a much more durable economic engine. That leads to sustainability, that leads to a permanent organization. And that has always been one of our primary goals, to create a permanent organization, to be able to serve families long after I'm not here. And this was always my father's expression. This is going to go on beyond me, because he was the only credible person in the room 25 years ago, or the most credible person. I was 29, 30 years old, and everyone kept saying, Carl, what happens when you die? And he said, we're going to create an organization that's going to go on. So that has always been one of our goals. And if one of your overriding goals is permanence, it governs every decision you're making. And so when I thought about putting these two businesses together, and a third being the non-US component, which had real estate and wealth management, it really lined up quite nicely. Doing that privately would have been challenging, just governance and how do you create a common currency. And as I thought about solving for a permanent organization, being public is part of that solution. The SPAC, and so the concept of this started in 2020 as I was thinking about it, and we were all home and a lot more time to think. And around Thanksgiving in 2020, I said, I actually think this is something worth pursuing, and began having conversations about it, putting the businesses together. And at that point, SPACs were obviously in existence, had been in existence for some while, but it wasn't until really about a year later where there was that plethora of speculative SPACs that came in. It really became an issue. So we were already on the path to going this route, and watched the SPAC space turn into a very frothy, speculative, highly criticized, and then the SEC came and shut it down. So our journey saw the entire perception of SPACs, and then we were really felt like the last one standing when we finally listed in January of 23. We'd gone through all the banks moved away and out of SPACs, and it was, for us, it was an ability to merge three businesses, have the SPAC sponsor value the three businesses. He was the valuation expert, as opposed to having ongoing partners valuing each other against each other and having the tension that comes out of that. And then we've been integrating since we launched. And now we obviously, in the back half of the year, we made a bunch of decisions related to the business in terms of streamlining and exiting certain business components that were more transactional in nature. And then we began creating the pipeline, EEA being, or East End being an example of that. And obviously went out and met with the Allianz team and the Constellation team, and really walked through our strategy and our next 5 years, and they obviously underwrote it, did a lot of work on us, spent a lot of time with the team.
Why did that conversation make sense at that moment?
Growth capital, but also strategic growth capital. And both Allianz and Constellation bring different things, and they like the fact that each one is in with us, and they, I think, appreciate what each of them brings. Allianz is one of the best run organizations, obviously insurance and asset management. They're enormous, and they are truly global. And I think as they looked at us, they saw our model, which is the independent model and the open architecture model. And they ultimately believe that is a model to take forward and one to certainly invest in. And as they think about the many very large families that they serve and the family businesses that they serve and have served for decades and decades, the one thing that was not there was a wealth management, at the very high end, a wealth management solution for their very large clients that are in many of these jurisdictions. And we happen to be in many of the jurisdictions which they operate. So I think they like the appeal of that. We're obviously in Hong Kong and Singapore and all throughout Europe and the States.
And then there are obviously new jurisdictions that we can approach together over time.
Where do efficiencies of scale come in with ultra high net worth clients?
We think scale, it's interesting. A lot of large families are skeptical about scale. Oh, you're too big, you're growing too fast, you're too much change. And I understand that concern. However, scale needs to benefit clients. So we've always approached scale from the standpoint of efficiency of delivery of the service. So our systems ultimately will be slightly cheaper as we get more scale. The terms that we can negotiate will be better. All of that accrues to our client base. Importantly, as we've grown, and this is very much, again, an intentional operating methodology, is because of the way we collaborate, we actually have create a repository of information. Clients work with us on various projects. We've done estate planning. We've seen stuff work, not work, work really well. We've done family dynamics. We have this incredible central repository of family-related information that helps the next advisor when he comes up and a family has a situation. That scale is part of that. But ultimately, the benefit of the scale needs to accrue to families. I mean, they really do need to feel that and see that. And that's one of, again, thinking from the outside, looking at the business, that's one of the things that we need to do a good job of in practice and in reality, but also in terms of how we explain our growth and the dynamic nature of our business.
Is the tech stack at Tiedemann consistent across the globe?
Yes, to the degree that it can. And then there are just certain systems that are not, that don't transfer or translate as well. So there's, for example, our client reporting system and the reports, it is consistent, but there are nuances. You have FX forwards and other dynamics that are non-US, different currency denominations. So we have, there are differences, but things like Salesforce, Adapar, there are ones that are cutting across our human resources, but there are different payroll systems in different countries. And there's some stuff. We are in the final straws of interviewing for a CTO, and that centralization and the use of AI to help create risk oversight and various help with RFPs and various things to create some efficiency where you can have real system automation, reducing human errors, and then have the human oversight. These are primary goals for certainly the next 12 months, but beyond that.
Have you seen technology make your business more efficient in the last 25 years?
Yeah, absolutely. No question. And what people view, understandably, technology with a sort of a weary, that people look at it and have their concerns about what it means for employment and what have you. And there's good reason for that. But ultimately, it enables humans in a business like ours to have their time being spent on much more value add, much more important components. It can be engagement with clients rather than working on spreadsheets, or it can be reviewing spreadsheets rather than creating them yourselves. And so there's that component, but then there's also controls, and automation is critically important when you have just a slew of moving pieces and moving entities and transactions. And just as the more that you grow, the more it's critically important that you have systems that can keep up with that and really manage that.
What's the team learned over the years that they've been actively engaged in values-based investing that you see other people are just catching up to now?
One of the most powerful components to all of it is it's very personalized. And so value-based investing, almost by definition, it's like, what are your values? Are they the same or different than mine? Our families go through the exercise of, and it's a multi-generational exercise. And that's, I think, one of the coolest parts of it, is that you have families, you have parents, and the children, typically it's two generations, really trying to identify what it is that they care about, care most deeply about. And they view their capital then as an opportunity to invest in, participate in, drive change. And that, I think, is the most unique dynamic that I've seen. Obviously, climate's a big one. I think virtually all families, irrespective of their political leanings, would say that they are interested in climate solutions, whether it be applications to old industry that make them carbon neutral, and then there are various other social elements that, depending on the family, the families and members of the families, they can express themselves. And so it's our job to really help the families go through that process and journey of discovery, and then giving them the tools to which then to allocate their capital and activate their capital. And so it's not for all of our families. Some people don't even want to discuss it. it's linked to ESG, but impact investing is typically more oriented towards the private markets. And the part about impact investing that really excites families a year, 2 years, 3 years in, you have the financial results. And we have non-concessionary and catalytic investing, which to us is really saying, look, you're going to make it a non-concessionary, is we're going to be investing in impact in these spaces, but we expect capital market returns to be competitive, and they have been historically. And then there are people who are willing to accept lower returns for a defined purpose that they think is critically important to their mission and values. But it's been an incredibly important component to our business and really enables us to engage the families and for the families themselves to engage in discussions about their money very differently than they otherwise would be able to.
Merger activity has been robust for over a decade with over 300 transactions in 22 and 23. Can the multiples that are being paid be justified long term?
In private markets, I think the adjustments are slowly coming. There was a lot of money raised because we're in a zero rate environment. So there was a lot of private equity money raised to focus on the space because in many ways, it's a SaaS business. And so just like with SaaS, obviously there are these multiples that they assume that you're going to be able to grow into. I think the difference between SaaS business and this business is you got underlying markets that have an impact on revenues. So depending on the model and depending on how much of it is related to portfolio performance versus services, it's called fixed rate services, I think that's a nuance. But you're beginning to see the adjustment of multiples, the lowering of them, or that in structure. So more earnout, a little bit more protection for the buyers. But they're still very full. I'm not going to give you a yes or no.
No one does.
No, I think these are really good businesses if they're very well run.
But at 12 times EBIT, it gets a little rich.
Oh, but bigger businesses are trading at 20 plus.
Yeah.
Right. So 12, I have no issue with 12. 12 to 15 is a multiple that I think these businesses, if you run them, integrate them, and run them with discipline and are able to enhance organic growth, I think I'd be a buyer all day long of these businesses. That's a personal comment.
What was it like being CIO of Tiedemann in 2008?
For us, 2008 started in 2007, and it really began with our understanding of what was going on with the CDO, collateralized debt obligation market, and understanding that market had frozen and was really in reverse and becoming highly problematic. At the time, I was perhaps the most depressing dinner date you could ever have because I was telling people buy gold, sell everything. I really thought 08 was gonna happen in 07, in the summer of 07 in particular. And it took a year plus for that to happen, but we mobilized a lot of capital out of alternatives in particular, out of non-dollar equities. And that changed the trajectory of our business. You can say that either saved our business or we would have, like others, been under tremendous pressure. But we raised an immense amount of cash to the point where had 08 not happened, had Lehman not gone under, we were getting clients were taking capital from us because we were raising so much cash, and they said, where are you gonna invest it? We said, we're not. We're just hoarding it in cash money markets that are treasury only, that have no links to banks. And that was not a great answer for people. And so that was an interesting time. And then obviously it happened, and we then began trying to redeploy capital. That was the other end of the spectrum, trying to convince people to buy consumer staple equities or things like MLPs, which had like tremendous yields. And there was just a lot of, the discounting that was occurring in Q1 of 09, and people forget the stock market was down 25% again in Q1 of 2009 before it turned and rallied to this point. But the psychology of investing was so dominant at that point, you could not get people to deploy their capital. And so then by the end of the year, I said, geez, you didn't do that. You wouldn't let me invest. So it was a very interesting time to be in the seat. I'm very proud of decisions we made on balance. We really made a lot of decisions. We got our clients through one of the more complicated and terrifying times. And I think that really led to a lot of families that were very disappointed by their advisors coming and meeting us and seeing the decisions that we had made and understanding what we viewed our edge was, or informational edge was, that led us to make those decisions. And then we kept building from there. But luckily, there are much better people in the seat running the investment firm today, Nancy Curtin, and prior to that, Kent Inslee, and we have a really great investment team. And you know, I was the person for the time, but not the person for the future.
What's Alti's outlook now on venture? How do you engage with venture?
Venture, and then let's call it like the Series B and growth equity. There's, as we look at that spectrum, for starters, we believe in vintage risk as a primary risk in private equity investing generally. And really all that means is making sure that you have some diversification. You have to sort the great operators in these spaces that you believe have a competitive advantage. And they tend to be the ones that are most disciplined. They tend to be the ones that always get deal access. And then it's just ultimately depends one fund to the next one to the next, making sure that you have a commitment to the space of investing in venture, in growth equity, in private equity generally, that has a measure of time diversification as well as strategy diversification. Now, you can be overly diversified, so I'm not suggesting that, but really making sure that you're not saying, this is the vintage and I'm going to bet it all on venture in 2023 or 2024. We believe there are signals that you can see when you've invested with funds and you see their divestments and how, and you really get into the weeds of what is driving their IRRs that they're marketing, what their pipeline looks like, and then what the valuation framework and the exit environment looks like for their prior deals, as well as the valuation environment that they are investing into. And so that's where that informs a lot of ultimately our team's allocation to the space. But then there's co-investment, so direct investing in specific deals where, you know, a lot of our clients have expressed an interest in that. That's the edge of risk. I mean, that really is the riskiest part of investing, is that co-investment. But typically these are high conviction businesses that the fund is a full position in, and then they've got an excess $20, $30, $50 million to allocate. And we've expressed interest in participating. So we do get shown those. And then it really, you go out to clients who have expressed interest in participating directly through us in that, and we offer that.
And what about private credit?
I'm more bearish on private credit than the average person. I think it's a great time to be raising money in the space. I think it's actually it's a good time, if you have discipline, to be deploying it. I think too much money has been raised. And I think the cost of capital is going to be the story that you hear about in the next 3 years in terms of businesses that just, there was no room for error and the margins weren't there and the cost of capital was too extreme. So I think it's not like public market credit related issues where you see a company necessarily. These are going to be a lot of smaller businesses that really should be a lot of work out. I think the space is going to have some headwinds in the coming years, but it's a great operators will be fine. Great operators will work through that and or are going up quality to the firms that they're lending to. But it's certainly a space that has garnered a lot of attention and a lot of capital.
Do you see any interesting opportunities globally?
The non-US markets and emerging markets, when you think about the last 12 plus years, you've had an incredible flow of capital into US markets, and the US market continues to outperform. But you're seeing some really good global allocators who are participating in the US, but also able to participate in the EM markets where inflation and where monetary policy was maybe perhaps ahead of the Fed, where their currencies have stabilized and the balances, their trade balance and fiscal balances are more in line and there's actual growth, but there just weren't capital flows. And you're beginning to see capital flows normalize. And that can create, I think, some outsized returns for the investors that really do a great job of finding the leaders in those countries, the leading corporations in those countries in which to invest. So I do think global investing over the next decade, non-US investing over the next decade will actually, it will be a time to make sure you have some exposure there. Not necessarily an all-in exposure, but really making sure you're participating in a lot of the non-US markets.
You've managed money for many Wall Street titans over the years and worked with them closely. Do you think these notable investors manage their own personal family money well?
That's a loaded question. I think when you say Wall Street titan, that you can, there can be
brilliant business builders who spend all their time focused on building businesses and not necessarily investing their capital. That term, Wall Street Titan, really is a range of things. When you boil it down, I think they're the most efficient clients in many ways when you're talking about their investment portfolio, because you're talking about a long-term plan. They are extremely well-versed in markets and understand what they do and don't want exposure to. And you walk through the plan and they'll say, yes, no, yes, maybe. You have to show me more on that. Like, they very quickly can map out what they think makes great long-term sense. It's an incredible opportunity for our advisors and our investment team to pick their brains and to really understand what they're thinking and seeing and what they're hearing and the anecdotes that they have. Those tend to be very fruitful conversations for us and educational in some instances, but it's all over the board in terms of whether or not they're great investors. Some of them are just less interested in necessarily the results. They want to make sure that their family's well looked after, and they want to make sure that their results are competitive. And then episodically, they will see an idea and they'll say, hey, what do you think about this? I'm hearing a lot about this. What do we have that we can invest in? What's your views on it? They want to be able to have a very timely conversation, have options to invest in, or in many cases, they're looking for the counter arguments. Like, I'm hearing a lot about Bitcoin. Should I be there? Should I not be there? Why shouldn't I be there? What do you think about these NFTs and subjects that are new investments? I'll never forget in 2007 explaining to, and these were my father's contemporaries, what a CDO was. And they all just sat there in silence as I spoke. And it was, you did not get a lot of these gentlemen to sit in silence to listen to you. But I was explaining the complexities and the fact that ISDA agreements were different in every bank, and the fact that these were all listed at AAAs, and how the rating agencies were getting paid huge fees if they bumped it up to AAA, and then the buyers were just blindly buying these pools and the underwriting, and everyone was selling off the risk to one after the next, and then they were leveraging it. And they just sat there, oh God, how does this end? And I was like, I don't think it ends well. Yeah. So I would have conversations like that, but that's not these were brilliant investors. That was just a whole nother asset class that didn't exist previously. And so it's fun when you have an opportunity to sit and talk to brand name Wall Street legends and engage in these dialogues. It's a real honor, and it's a lot of fun for the team as well.
Mike Tiedemann, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your excellent and wonderful insights.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or share it with your friends. Thank you.